Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars, creators, and industry leaders keeping theater alive during the pandemic. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the writer Chiara Alegria Hudes. She's a playwright whose work includes Miss You Like Hell, Daphne's Dive, Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue, and Water by the Spoonful, the play that won her the Pulitzer Prize for Drama in 2012. She's also the author of a just-released memoir, My Broken Language. But her breakout work was In the Heights, the Tony-winning musical she wrote with Lin-Manuel Miranda, and which is now a new movie musical, for which she also wrote the screenplay. Hudes is in the virtual studio with me to talk cuts, updates, the food bubbling on Abuela Claudia's stove, and why filming on location in Washington Heights was like a great big block party. Hi, Chiara. Thanks for joining me.
Hi. My pleasure.
One of the things that is so thrilling about watching the In the Heights movie, and it's particularly striking in those opening moments, is that it's really joyful seeing these this vibrant opening number happening in New York City in a really specific location that reminds us New Yorkers of the way New York was kind of before the pandemic, and it made me think what for you was opened up in the story in a new way now that you were able to follow these characters to these very real places and to this very real neighborhood that sort of helped inspire the story in the first place?
It was two things, and they kind of go in opposite directions. One was the opportunity to kind of get as big and epic as a Hollywood budget allows, as a large movie screen allows. So that's when you're saying, like, okay, Carnaval, how many bodies do we really want crammed into that alley singing that song on the hottest day of the summer? So that's really exciting. It's, you know, 96,000. Once we had the idea to set it in the pool, it's like, I mean, that pool is, by the way, humongous. So if you don't get enough people, it's just going to kind of look lame. You have to fill it with people, and you need a lot of people to do that. And we, you know, the opportunity to cast out of the neighborhood for that. So there's that one direction that, you know, we're dreaming and imagining in. But the other direction is the opportunity to get smaller than you can get on a Broadway stage, you know, because if Abuela Claudia is talking to Nina about Nina's hard year at college in a Broadway house, that has to be as clear and palpable for someone sitting in the back row as for someone sitting in the front row. So it requires an amount of projection, vocal projection, that, you know, is different than a very private moment might be. And because it's a unit set on the Broadway stage, that the setting of that conversation is outside. You know, so the opportunity to actually go to a more personal space, to go inside Abuela's house, to have this conversation about what is troubling Nina, for instance, they can be a little more personal and a little more real behind closed doors. Plus, we get to see the food that is bubbling on Abuela's stove tops. Just these kind of very quiet, intimate moments that we gain access to. So that's what I was like super psyched to dig into in the screenplay is those extremes.
And how detailed did you as the writer get in terms of this scene takes place on this particular corner or in this, you know, particular tunnel in this one subway station, or, you know, Claudia is cooking this on her stove? Like, how detailed, how much were you engrossed in those details, and how much was that the work of like a, you know, a location scout and a set decorator and things like that?
Well, I will tell you, in the screenplay, it's like, there is steam rising from Abuela's bubbling ropa vieja. Okay. So like, yeah, I like scripted the steam. Okay. And when John Chu and I started talking about production, he's like, you know, Chiara, I can tell from your screenplay that you feel some type of way about food. So do you want to have a lot of control in this regard? I'm like, yes, please. And he gets it because his parents, you know, I grew up in, my abuela's kitchen, but also in restaurants. My parents had a restaurant called El Viejo San Juan in Philly. His dad is, of course, Chef Chu. So food, you know, that's one particular element we really connected over. And then there's things that I put in the script that a location scout will change. So when I wrote Paciencia y Fe, for instance, I was like, okay, which subway station am I going to set this in? And, you know, I kind of toured around the neighborhood. And what I wanted to emphasize was how difficult public transit access can be for elderly people uptown, because the elevators and the escalators break all the time. They're always out of service. And because of the very unusual topography up here, there's the bedrock that is so hard to drill into and to flatten. These are steep ascents and descents. So I was imagining, okay, hottest day of the summer, Abuela Claudia is going to go take a subway ride. And I was imagining it was the A stop at 181st and Fort Washington. That's a very precipitously steep escalator ride. And if the escalator is out of service, what is it for that old woman's knees to walk up and down? You see it every day, you know? So then when we did the location scout, John Chu fell in love with the one stop that has the long tunnel.
Right.
I mean, actually, when we got to that tunnel, he and Lynn were running back and forth through it like little boys. I was like, oh my God. Just like enjoying the echo of it, enjoying the kind of the depth of the depth field depth of that visual. And so it became clear that the tunnel was going to replace the escalator. So, but it still has that kind of epic journey in the mundane every day.
Mm. And what, tell us a little bit more about that process of translating that story to the screen in terms of what were your overall goals, not only in bringing it to the screen, but in bringing it to the screen, you know, more than 10 years after, you know, you were first working on that show. What were sort of some of your goals there?
So many. One is just to really honor the medium of film as something different. I didn't want to get stuck in this like weird in-between gear where we're trying to preserve a stage musical and then therefore it feels like a stage musical. Honestly, I was like, let's just make a movie. Okay. And I really had faith that because of Lynn's incredible songs, that it would be hard to lose the DNA, like spiritual core of the piece. I was like, we're going to retain that, but let's not be afraid of changes. And, one of the things I really spent a lot of time thinking about was the transition from scene to song and how that works differently on stage and on the screen. I think, you know, the convention of going and paying a lot of your hard-earned money to see a Broadway musical is you just sit down and you know there's going to be transition from scene to song. It's part of the buy-in, right? And you know the building that is the Rosario car service is make-believe, just like you know the transition from scene to song is make-believe. I think that it works differently on screen because the Rosario car service is not make-believe. We filmed it in an actual car service on that block, you know? So for them to start singing there, okay, what, you know, so how do I go there and let it be, you know, John Chu was so clear. He wanted to dream really, really big with these musical numbers and he has such a striking visual style. He works with dance so well. So how do we transition from in those real locations without it feeling like corny, without people tuning out, you know? And so the creative solution I came up with was Usnavi's telling his story. And I kept thinking about The Princess Bride, right? Like Peter Falk opens the book. And once we know it's the storytelling, you kind of go anywhere with it because you know, it's a narrator and we know narrators are unreliable and we want their unreliability, you know? So that's why literally Usnavi says once upon a time at the beginning, because I'm like, if we remember that this is all through his lens, then he saw 96,000 as a song. He saw that day at the pool as a song. You know, he right. looked at Nina and Benny flirting across the street in the dispatch, and he imagined they were singing a love song. We know it's from his imagination. And I also put in the line when he's telling the kids on the beach, he's saying, you know, once upon a time in this place I loved called Washington Heights, the streets were made of music. So that we can hear as an audience and they can hear, the kids can hear his story, which is like, yeah, that's that's how he heard things. And it relates back to something Lynn told me back in 2004 when we first started working on it together, which is, this was before I moved to Washington Heights and I was kind of new to New York. He's like, come uptown, we're gonna walk around the neighborhood, we're gonna spend a lot of time in the neighborhood together. And indeed, it was very familiar, like North Philly was, because the windows are open, people are blasting their music. You hear bachata one way, you hear hip hop another way, you hear reggaeton coming from there, and it's all clashing and it's all alive. And so, when Usnavi says the streets were made of music, he's telling a tall tale, but he's also describing reality.
Yeah. And you also, the story is updated to include things that are more recent past and sort of what was going on in the US at the time and still. Tell us a little bit about sort of what guided you there and what made you interested in that and how you kind of threaded that needle in terms of working that in to the story that already existed.
Right. There were a lot of questions. When did we want to set it? Do we want to set it when the Broadway show opened, which is when it was written for, or did we want to set it basically now, which is when I was writing the screenplay, now being, 2019, let's say. And there's pros and cons to each approach, but I guess the question was, why not set it now? And we didn't have the story still felt relevant. It still felt like something that would be resonant to those blocks. So we went for it, but it did require some updating because, for instance, if they're bantering about a lottery ticket and having a lot of fun with it, Benny's not going to put the name Donald Trump in his mouth. Like it's some fun joke. So we had to address, how would these characters say these words today? And another thing that had happened was, immigration has always been a really central component to the community. Not just headlines, but, our lived lives, the lives of our loved ones and our neighbors. But the rhetoric around it and what had been happening in the nation had reached such a fever pitch that I think it would be hard for someone like Sonny to not have that more actively on his mind. And I say Sonny because he was always kind of the social conscience of the block. He jokes, but he talks about labor movements. He's talking about underage cousins of Bodega Workers Unite. Well, guess what? He's probably knows about Cesar Chavez and Dolores Huerta, who were Latinos who founded groundbreaking labor movements. So I'm like, Sonny would be the one that is, would be protesting this stuff. I honestly think if I was still writing the screenplay a year ago, Sonny would be at a Black Lives Matter protest and he'd be looking his neighbors in the eye being like, why aren't you coming with me? Why does this not matter to you? So, it was fun to think about what's on Sonny's mind.
And as you were doing this, how much were you in conversation with Lynn about all the stuff that you were thinking about cutting and changing and rearranging? And how precious are either of you with this material?
I would say neither of us is precious with stuff. We really, now that we've been writing In the Heights together since 2004, we have thrown... Listen, he has thrown out extraordinary songs because they don't work in the script, and I have, we've thrown out so much material always in service of, is it enough? Is it the final version? That being said, we also have a lot more information now about the stuff that fans really love, that audiences really connect with. So you don't want to lose the stuff that makes the thing the thing. How involved was Lynn in those? I will say at the beginning, basically not at all. And what had happened was he was writing this other show is called Hamilton. He was a little busy with that. So I said to him, Lynn, I have some ideas. But I kind of, first of all, don't want to pitch them to you in a conversation because I'd like the writing to be the pitch. And he was like, great, because I'm busy. So you just go take care of that and let me know when you have something for me to look at. And so it was actually this opportunity for me to kind of like sneak away, make some really bold changes that I had wondered about, not questioning about the stage show, but about how that would translate onto screen. And then I invited him over to my studio, which is where I'm talking from right now. And I was like, we started on page one of my screenplay. I had cut the character of Camila, which was big, which I had never discussed with him. I had turned Daniela and Carla, therefore, into the married couple, the business owner couple of the community. I had cut some songs. You know, we knew we were going to have to make cuts in order to focus the story, but I hadn't told him about what my ideas were in terms of those cuts. So we're starting on page one and we're reading through the opening number and he's like, where's Camila? And I was like, let's just keep reading. He was like, Chiara, you know, and then we get a little further and he's like, Daniela and Carla, whoa, you know, and I was like, let's keep reading. And by the end, you know, he really bought into, those ideas. I think it was really helpful to have time and distance so we could kind of rip off the Band-Aid of some of those, you know, we cut songs we love. We cut a character we love. These aren't things we don't like about the show. Mm-hmm. And then after that point, then he really got his hands dirty with me. And, you know, we got more to the detail work of like, which songs are we going to change? Did he agree with the song cuts? That sort of stuff.
Yeah. And you've talked about John Chu, the director who directed Crazy Rich Asians, and he's going to be working on the Wicked movie. Can you tell us a little more about how you would characterize his vision and the voice that he brought to the film and why he's such a good fit for musicals in particular?
I mean, I would say we're all, many of us are very familiar with Lin's real kind of deep roots in hip hop, of his facility with the genre and the history there. John Chu came to us with a very comparable facility and breadth of knowledge about dance on film. You know, he had earned his stripes. He had real chops in that and had real vision with that. By the same token, the reason he was interested in it was not just so that he could like do another dance movie, but he said to us, he was like, you know, my parents came from China. Like, I literally don't know what their childhood looks like. You know, I relate, this is my story too. And it's that very personal connection married with that bold visual style and that like big kinetic dance impulse that he has that felt like a really exciting combination to work together on.
I'll have more with Chiara right after the break. Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
And now, here's more with Chiara Alegria-Hudis. Going back a little bit to the filming of the movie, when was that? That was when did the movie shoot, and how? What are your memories of that time?
It reminds me a little bit of, you know, I'm from Philadelphia. I'm not from New York, but I was, the reason Lin and I found each other is because I was writing plays out of the Latino community in Philadelphia. And so it reminds me of something that I experienced a lot as a kid in Philly, which is like in the hottest days of the summer when people need baby pools, when people are going to jack open a hydrant, like people will park a car to block on either end of a block so that there can be no through traffic. And therefore you create an outdoor patio where everyone can come and get relief from the heat. So filming the movie was like that, except for we just had to get city permits to do it. Like we basically like roped off blocks as much as we could. We invited neighbors to come join us. So the neighbors would bring out their folding chairs. They would bring us like coquito and like frituras, like little fried treats, whatever they had made that day, tostones or whatever. And they would watch too. They would lean over and watch on my little iPad that I was watching the filming on. And we got to know them over time. You know, there were some who would just come and look once and leave. There were some that were super annoyed that we were like in their way. And there were some that came every day and became our friends. So it was really cool to kind of have this block party vibe, you know, to that.
Yeah. And how do you remember feeling back when you found out? Because, you know, we were all looking forward to seeing the movie in June of 2020. And how do you remember feeling about it being pushed back at the time? And now, how do you think about how the film will play for audiences after we've all been through, you know, what we've all been through over the last year, 18 months?
You know, I honestly, when we made the decision to push back the release, I felt relief. I had a lot of faith that In the Heights doesn't become outdated over the course of 12 months, because we had been trying to make this movie for a long time and we hit a lot of roadblocks on the way. We, you know, it never got made at Universal because of budget issues and like, oh no, there's no Latino stars that test international and blah, blah, blah. You know, for all these reasons, it didn't get made there. And when you're in the middle of those roadblocks, they're frustrating. And then what happens is you realize, okay, but it actually led to something better. That kept happening. Like that happened, but then we found John Chu, you know? So I was like, I just trust the universe that a 12-month delay is going to happen for a reason. And it was like last summer we were still reeling. We still hadn't hugged our loved ones.
Right.
It was a painful time. And people, you know, the New York Times was not concerned with exciting summer movies. The New York Times was, you know, tallying their death toll. That didn't feel like a good time to put out the movie. We were just trying to make it through the days safely. Now that we have begun safely hugging our loved ones again, it feels like the time to remember what this movie is full of in every frame, which is neighbors hanging out and talking in each other's faces in the bodega, neighbors hanging like squeezed in tight at the dance club. You know, now does feel like a really good time for that kind of joy medicine, that love medicine, that excitement medicine.
Where will you be on opening night? Do you know where you will see it that on the night it opens?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put on some makeup and put on some fancy clothes, and I'm going to walk about 8 blocks that way to my left and go see it at the United Palace in Washington
Excellent.
Heights.
Yeah, cool. Let's talk a little bit about your memoir that was released in April. Was writing a memoir something you had always wanted to do? And if not, what made you decide to do it?
Think I like grew up being like, one day I'm gonna write my memoir. But my pop, he did always have this thing where he'd be like, so when are you writing your book? You know, from the time I was basically writing professionally, which probably started in like 2002. When are you writing your book? When are you writing your book? I'd be like, hey, pop, I don't know, I'm not writing my book. And then one day I was like, oh, this is what he was asking me about. I'm writing my book now. And I think in part, I was writing about our community's history. So, and that history included, I'm talking about North Philly. I'm talking about the Puerto Rican community in North Philly, the 80s and 90s. And that was a history of real like musical innovation. So Juan Luis Guerra comes out with Bachata Rosa. It was also a time of profound tragedy, the AIDS epidemic, the crack cocaine epidemic. And these were things that affected my family and that I did not understand many of us didn't understand as we were living through it. And with decades of hindsight, I have begun to understand a little bit more. And that feels like the right time. I could never be a reporter. I can't report from something in the middle of it. Hindsight is very helpful for me. So I said, okay, let's look at that time and how did we survive? And who did we become through that survival?
And as you went back and thought about the community, the whose story you were telling, and your own story as you were telling it, were there events that you came to recognize as formative for you that you maybe hadn't noticed or seen that way before?
The one that that triggered it all, actually, was I was visiting California. I think I was working on my musical Miss You Like Hell at La Jolla Playhouse. And my cousin Elliot lives not too far from me. He lived in LA, so he drove down to visit. And he was like, look what I brought. And he had this DVD, but it wasn't marked or anything. So it was clearly a dub. And he popped it in to my artist housing DVD player. And it was a digitized version of an old VHS home movie. And it was 4th of July, 1991. And there we are, me and Abuela and my cousins and my tias. And we're in North Philly in Abuela's little row home. And we're dancing our asses off to Bilirubina by Juan Luis Guerra, which was a seminal song. Okay, that song was a game changer. And it's the lyrics, you know, me sube la bilirubina, my adrenaline rises. It's a love song. And we're dancing our asses off and we're crammed in tight together like sardines. Okay, because it's a big fit. It's a lot of women. It's a little space. And the joy is unbelievable. And there I was. I remembered it so well. It was a memory I had forgotten until then. And the joy was very moving. And then I remembered what a hard year that was in my family. We lost people because of gun violence. We lost people from HIV. And we lost people from addiction. And not death, yes, but also just they lost years of wellness. You know, some of them survived too. So to see that joy, but to remember the setting of it, that's what incited me to write the whole book. Then I had to remember other things. I remembered a summer not too long before then, a few years before that, where I got my first period. Like, you know, I didn't see it coming. I was a 10-year-old and I'd gone to Six Flags with my cousin, you know, my cousins, and they took care of me. They were my cool, badass older cousins. And I was scared and I didn't know what was happening to me. And they took care of me, you know, remembering that care that they treated me with. So yeah, a lot of seminal memories.
Yeah. And in addition to the memoir and In the Heights, what else have you got on your plate coming up? I know you worked on an animated musical with Lynn called Vivo that's coming to Netflix soon? Yes.
Yes. I think it's been announced as part of like their summer offerings or something. I'm not sure of a date yet, but I'm so excited about Vivo. I can't wait. And you know, I'm not allowed to talk too much about it, but I can say like they've announced his character, and so it's really fun. It's got that classic Lin-Manuel effervescence and lightness. It mixes all these different musical genres. But the thing I personally love about it the most is some of the characters, which I can't talk about. But the other thing is, like, I am a hopeless romantic, and that's a side of me I've never written about before. And Vivo's the first time I write it. So in my real life in high school in Philly at Central High School, I met my husband. We fell in love. We've been together since then. And so there's this whole romantic side of me I've never written about, because honestly, it's like not that dramatic. but here I came up with a dramatic romantic plot. And so the hopeless romantic in me has now been filtered through this animated family movie, which I'm super excited about. And yeah, it's about a musician in Cuba who wants to fulfill a wish to deliver a love song to his long lost love.
And will you and Lynn work on anything for the stage again, do you think?
We don't have any plans. I like to eavesdrop. You know, what we do now that we're just friends, in addition to being collaborators, we always call each other when we have new ideas. And, you know, so I like to hear what he's thinking of for the stage. I share with him my inspirations. And no, right now, my projects are mine.
Yeah. And what are they? Can tell us about some of those that you're working on.
I'm really excited. I took a pause from theater for a little bit and I'm excited to return. I'm writing lyrics for a music theater adaptation of Como Agua para Chocolate, like water for chocolate. I'm doing lyrics, which is super fun. And with the amazing composers of La Santa Cecilia, a phenomenal band. And the script is really good, written by Lisa Loomer. So yeah, I'm super excited about that one.
Yeah. And what made theater the thing that you first gravitated towards, the form that you really started to write in?
It's a few things. One is that growing up, my aunt, Linda Hudes, who I was really close with, she wrote the music for the Big Apple Circus for 20 years. So she taught me music, and every year I would come up and she taught me how to read music. So I would turn her during rehearsal when she was stationed in New York for 3 months out of the year, because the rest of the year they were touring. I would turn her pages on the bandstand as they rehearsed. She played keys in the band, and her husband was the trumpeter and the band leader. So I would watch the clowns rehearse, and like, I would watch the acrobats rehearse. And I think that I just fell in love with the liveness of it all. So that's part of it. And the other part is honestly like a little bit of like scheming and strategy, which is when I got to Yale, I was a music major. I had studied music all my life, but for me, music wasn't just Western classical music. It was the bata drumming of my mom's spiritual practice. It was the Juan Luis Guerra, as I've mentioned. My aunt was also a punk rock musician, and she played at CBGB and would take me to her gigs. So it was like punk rock, you know, it was like being the only chick instrumentalist in sight at CBGB, surrounded by all these like hardcore dudes. So for me, music was all of these things. When I got to Yale and it was like, oh no, music has one definition. It has one culture. It has one skin tone. It has one history. And we listen to it only sitting down. We do not dance to music. I was like, oh, okay, well, what do I do now? And my solution was, if I write a musical — I wrote some musicals, Yale — if I wrote a musical that the plot was about these Boricua characters, then they couldn't tell me not to compose music that was appropriate to them. So it was actually like this like weird little bit of cultural scheming that brought me to playwriting.
And now that we're all getting ready at some time within the next 6 months to a year, be back in a theater watching a show, what do you hope to see from theater overall as we move out of the pandemic and into kind of a return to activities with all the, you know, hindsight of everything we've been through in the last several months?
I mean, it's counterintuitive response in this interview, because yes, Broadway, amazing, la la la, like that's, you know, how In the Heights catapulted from a smaller piece to, you know, having kind of international recognition and being done all over the world. That being said, I really, my wishes for the theater in the immediate return are a little bit more neighborhood minded, and I just really hope that community theater can really come to life again. And I say community theater with total respect and not as a pejorative, but as the place where most people actually first interact with theater. So I want to see like theater in the parks. I want to see theater in the neighborhoods. You know, I think that our larger theatrical institutions do have a lot of work to do in terms of updating themselves to 2021. They have some stubborn institutional habits that need some shifting. And I think actually that therefore neighborhood theater and community theater can lead the way, because those theaters are made of the people. That is theater of the people and for the people. And so that my wishes go towards them to really like leading the way and innovating on a local level.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing how things evolve. And we are very much looking forward to seeing In the Heights in June and everything else you have coming up. Thanks so much, Kiara. Thanks for joining me.
It's fun to talk. Thanks a lot.
That was Kiara Alegria Hudes, the screenwriter of In the Heights, in theaters and on HBO Max June 11th. You can pick up her memoir, My Broken Language, wherever you buy books. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, I'd really appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really helps us grow our audience of folks who love theater as much as you and I do. Or tell a friend about Stagecraft. Find past episodes or subscribe on all the pod places, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another new episode. Until then, find me on Twitter at @gcoxvariety. Thanks for listening. And see you soon.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah, not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.